This is black and brown students of color who are vulnerable in the sense that they have visas that could be revoked based on completely specious charges. And I feel horrible for her, as I do for Mahmoud and the other students who are cowering in their dorm rooms right now, afraid to leave the building because there are sketchy guys out front with big vans with tinted windows waiting for them. I can't overemphasize how frightening it is for our students to be attending a university, hoping to get an education when the university is actually collaborating in their very peril.
In this last 30 seconds, we have Professor Catherine Franke. How would you characterize this moment in time, this moment in U.S. history?
Well, I think what we're seeing, and this is what's happening at Columbia and these other schools, it's just a small piece, is the collapse of a constitutional order that the Trump administration has very deftly exploited. There are anti-democratic elements in our constitutional system that this administration has very adeptly exploited and has put out these test balloons, as I've said, with universities and law firms. And what they're about to do next, I think we all have to be very worried about.
And we're going to continue.
As we saw the Berlin Wall.
We're going to continue this discussion and post online at democracynow.org. Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School, as she puts it, the university retired her. To see our conversations with her in the past, go to democracynow.org and to see her.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO listeners, come join us Friday, April 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. here at the station for KBOO's April Fools for Fools First Friday Arts Walk for the eccentrics, the clowns, and the freaks. Enjoy an evening of art, live music, vendors, performers, food, drinks, and more. That's Friday, April 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. at 20 Southeast 8th Ave, Portland, Oregon. Can't wait to see you there. KBOO's Metal Marathon, the Metal March, is back once again. And that means brand new metal merch. Go to kboo.fm/metal to check out all KBOO's new metal merch featuring exclusive artwork provided by local artist and musician at Unicron Artworks. This year's Metal Marathon is live on KBOO Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Get your very own limited edition 2025 Metal March metal merch and listen to every installment of the Metal Marathon at kboo.fm/metal and support metal on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders give their feedback on proposed budget cuts to park and youth programs.
A surprising bit of warm weather graces the Portland area.
And proposed Medicaid reductions could impact a third of Oregonians.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 24th, 2025. I'm Nina Mayfair.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland is facing a $93 million budget shortfall in the general fund, and residents are weighing in on what should be cut. City councilors and the mayor have held two listening sessions so far in districts 1 and 3. Community members came out to support budget items like parks and youth programs, which could be on the chopping block. Budget recommendations published by the city manager last month listed cutting youth programs as one way to balance the budget. That would include closing the city youth basketball league, cutting summer camps, ending after-school programs, and even closing a community center. The parks department could see layoffs, especially in park maintenance jobs. Workers in the Parks Department warn Portland's parks will look very different without their maintenance work. Union representatives from across city departments are raising alarms about the 300 job cuts that could be on the line. Labor leaders offered their own budget recommendations, suggesting the mayor should reduce the number of contract employees and tap into city reserves. District 1 covers East Portland and has not enjoyed the same level of attention and investment from City Hall. This is the first budget cycle under the new system of government, and some folks at the listening station are emphasizing that cuts shouldn't come from their district, since they have catching up to do with the wealthier parts of town. Two more listening sessions are coming up next week. The District 4 listening session will be at the Portland Building on Tuesday, April 1st at 6 p.m. The District 2 listening session will be at PCC Cascade in the Moriarty Auditorium on Thursday, April 3rd at 6 p.m. Mayor Wilson's draft budget will be published in the beginning of May.
Portlanders can expect unusually warm conditions for the next 2 days, capped off by thunderstorms on Wednesday. Tuesday is expected to be the warmest day of the year so far, with a high of 77. The warmth continues through Wednesday midday until the afternoon, when a cold front is headed into town. That could spell thunderstorms and heavy rainfall on Wednesday afternoon. By Thursday, the weather is forecasted to return to something more typical for Portland in March, mid-50s and raining.
The Trump administration's planned cuts to the Medicaid program are likely to impact nearly a third of Oregonians. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services confirmed it will scale back federal contributions to several states, including Oregon, as part of a broader effort to rein in federal spending. Medicaid is a federal program that provides health coverage for low-income and disabled people. It was first signed into law in 1965. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek warns the cuts to Medicaid will pose serious consequences for low-income, vulnerable populations across the state. The Oregon Health Authority says that, as of February, Medicaid covered more than 1.4 million Oregonians, including roughly 57% of all children in the state. Kotek says the Trump administration's federal tax cut for billionaires will burden senior citizens and financially disadvantaged Oregonians who rely on Medicaid. Kotek told KGW, quote, "The federal dynamic has definitely created a lot of uncertainty. Governors have day-to-day duties. They need a federal government that's clear, consistent. What I'm finding as a governor is that that's very difficult with this administration because they're taking on a lot of things and doing it in a very erratic fashion, which is very hard for us," end quote. Governor Kotek said the state is not able to pick up the tab, which will result in significant cuts to the Oregon health plan. The full impact of the federal cuts may take months to be felt, but the concern is immediate. With the state's rising health care costs, an aging population, and a growing houseless crisis, Oregon's health care safety net is unlikely to be unable to shoulder the added burden. Oregon lawmakers passed a bill last week to extend taxes on insurance premiums and hospitals to help fund the Oregon health plan. But it can't fill the full gap that the Trump administration could cut. HB 2010 is headed to the governor's desk for signature.
Support is growing to advance state legislation known as Food for All Oregonians, which would remove barriers for older adults and children to receive food benefits based on immigration status. Its advocates say the bill would be cost-effective and is critical to lifting more Oregon families out of poverty. Isabel Charlet has more.
Hundreds of people from across Oregon gathered in Salem for an advocacy day last week, urging lawmakers to pass what's known as the Food for All Oregonians bill. Supported by a coalition of more than 180 organizations, it would ensure older adults and children could get food assistance regardless of their immigration status. Research shows hunger rates are rising across the state, leaving 1 in 6 children facing food insecurity. Oregon Food Bank's Christina Marquez says access to food benefits supported her family growing up and made it easier for her to go to college.
We know that programs like SNAP are the most effective anti-hunger tools we have. Being able to lift folks out of poverty each year and keeping families stable.
Food for All Oregonians would create a new state-run program similar to the federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Youth and older adults who would otherwise qualify for SNAP except for their immigration status would be eligible. Opponents of the bill are concerned about its cost. It is scheduled for a public hearing tomorrow in Salem. Oregon Food Bank points to data from the USDA showing every dollar spent on food assistance generates about $1.50 for local economies. Marquez adds immigrants of all statuses contribute to the state's functioning, especially in agriculture.
Many of the folks that would be affected by a passage of Food for All Oregonians are folks that are currently farm workers, essential workers, critical to many of the industries here in Oregon.
Marquez notes California and Washington have already enacted similar policies extending food benefits to people regardless of their immigration status. Food for All Oregonians is part of an immigrant justice package of bills which would ensure legal representation for immigrants and create a farm worker disaster relief fund. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Students, parents, and educators are weighing the impacts of Donald Trump's initial steps last week to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. A key area of concern is the future of student loan services. As Mike Moen reports, a national organization predicts more disruptions and offers tips for borrowers on how to work through any headaches.
Student loans are among the things the U.S. Department of Education oversees. Now that President Donald Trump has followed through on his threat to gut the agency, questions are mounting about the fate of loan services. On Thursday, President Trump signed an order he says begins the process of dismantling the department, even with questions about the limitations of executive power for this move. A White House official says the skeleton agency will continue to run student loans and Pell Grants, but higher education advocates still worry about borrowers running into issues. Mike Pierce of the Student Borrower Protection Center feels the system was already broken.
We expect that things will only get harder for working people with student debt and for families that are trying to pay for college.
Pierce says he hears from borrowers waiting on the phone for several hours to talk with private companies the government contracts with. He predicts longer delays. There's also concern about updating eligibility for income-driven repayment plans. The center says if you have service issues, contact your local congressional representative and submit what's called casework so that a staffer can help. The White House says its actions can drastically improve program implementation in higher education. Advocates also encourage families to see if their state has a student loan ombudsman where critical information can be found. The executive order comes after the administration recently cut 50% of the department's staff. Pierce says creating even more chaos and confusion could undercut the higher education path for students coming from disadvantaged households.
When these programs are run poorly, families that wouldn't otherwise be able to go to college, they're the first to miss out.
The department also is tasked with keeping for-profit colleges in check. Pierce says there's been a lot of progress in weeding out problematic schools, but he worries Trump's actions will lead to a resurgence of institutions engaging in predatory tactics. The Lumina Foundation has echoed similar concerns about the fate of the agency and the impact on student loans and financial aid. This is Mike Moen for United States News Service. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
Portland will look at redesigning the Tom McCall Waterfront Bowl thanks to a new grant from Metro. The big field south of the Hawthorne Bridge is home to the Waterfront Blues Fest each summer, but it doesn't get nearly as much use the rest of the year. That could change with a reimagining of the park, which could include terraced grass, an outdoor stage, and beachfront access to the Willamette. Metro granted Portland Parks and Recreation $750,000 for planning and development, kicking off a nationwide design search. They'll be partnering with advocates from the Human Access Project and the Portland Waterfront Pavilion, who have been working on revamping the bowl for years. Willie Levinson leads the Human Access Project, a group dedicated to re-engaging Portlanders with the Willamette River. He told the Portland Mercury, quote, "When we started our work 15 years ago, Portland wasn't ready for the conversation about redeveloping the riverfront bowl. There's been enough cultural movement now that we're ready for this next big thing. The hope is, by doing this and getting people to have positive investments in this river space, it'll catalyze and make other riverfront spaces more popular. When we invest in the river edge, people respond very well to it," End quote. The design phase of the project is scheduled to take 2.5 years. The redevelopment of the bowl coincides with other redevelopment projects in Portland's central city intended to re-engage locals and tourists alike. That includes the Steel Bridge Skate Park project, the James Beard Public Market, and the OMSI District redevelopment.
Lawmakers from both parties face angry constituents. Some have decided to skip town halls rather than address concerned voters. And Kentucky considers mandatory Medicaid work requirements. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
These are not normal times, right? These are not a situation of business as usual.
Speaking at a town hall, New Jersey Democratic Congressman Andy Kim says the U.S. may face a constitutional crisis under President Donald Trump. The administration's accused of ignoring orders from federal judges and calling for them to be impeached. Trump has also used his office for personal retribution and to sell cars. Members of Congress have been hosting volatile town halls where Trump is a main topic and been met with both cheers and jeers from their constituents. Democrats are facing boos for not pushing back effectively, but some Republicans have gotten an earful on Trump's economic impacts and the slash-and-burn cuts from Elon Musk and his advisory group. One Wyoming veteran told a representative cuts to the VA have damaged services without reducing real waste or corruption.
Having looked at Musk's Doge website, you are a lawyer. Where is this fraud?
Savings reported by Musk's Department of Government Efficiency have been riddled with errors and misstatements, but the Government Accountability Office estimated there was as much as $500 billion in budget waste over four previous years, citing emergency small business loans, a lack of tax law enforcement, and several areas within the Department of Defense. Some lawmakers are simply not showing up to events their offices had planned. Overflowing Iowa crowds came to talk about possible changes to Social Security, cuts to government agencies, and rollbacks of diversity programs. But Iowa AFL President Charlie Wishman says Representatives Marionette Miller-Meeks and Zach Nunn refused to face them.
And if they don't show up, we still have crowds that are standing room only or overflowing just to try and talk to an empty chair.
This comes as the administration plans to cut agricultural research in Iowa and close IRS, Food and Drug Administration, and Fish and Wildlife Service offices. Wishman says groups are working to get people to call, write emails, and send postcards. Meanwhile, with Congress debating a possible $900 billion cut to Medicaid, some Kentucky lawmakers want to add mandatory work requirements. House Bill 695 calls for able-bodied adults with no dependents to work 20 hours a week and prove it to get health coverage. But Emily Beauregard with Kentucky Voices for Health says that would mostly add red tape that pushes eligible households out of the system.
The majority of Kentuckians with Medicaid coverage are already working. They're working full-time, part-time, they're students, they're caregivers, taking care of children or older family members, people with disabilities.
Kentucky is one of the top 10 states by portion of the population covered by Medicaid. Supporters of the work requirements say the current system incentivizes people not to work, but rural hospitals say many of them would have to close without it. The Internal Revenue Service is working out an agreement to share data on undocumented immigrants with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A draft agreement shows the IRS will help verify if ICE has the right addresses. Estimates show more than 5 million undocumented immigrants paid $100 million in local, state, and federal taxes. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Forest Park Conservancy's legal action to block Portland General Electric from cutting down over 300 trees in Forest Park. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Last Straw Radio, interviewing the producers of KBOO's It Did Happen Here, 2 years after the completion of their series. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 68 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be overcast but warm with a daytime high of 76 degrees. Today in history, in 2018, students across the United States staged the March for Our Lives, demanding gun control after the Majorly Stoneman Douglas High School shooting. The quote of the day is from British-American political theorist Thomas Paine, who said, quote, "It is error only and not truth that shrinks from inquiry."
Mm-hmm.
New Mexico's state legislature unanimously passes a bill to create a new turquoise alert for missing indigenous people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A bill to create an alert system for missing indigenous people in New Mexico has passed the state legislature and heads to the governor's desk. Jeanette Didios has more.
The Turquoise Alert System will allow law enforcement to quickly share information about missing Indigenous people through news media, social networks, and digital highway signs without having to wait the standard 48 hours. According to the New Mexico Department of Justice, there are about 200 missing Indigenous people in the state. Bill's sponsor, Democratic Senator Angel Charlie, who's Laguna and Diné, shared the news on Instagram and said the system is not a tribal mandate, but will instead go through the Department of Public Safety.
It's not going to fix our jurisdictional complexity issues, but it is going to ensure that when a Native person goes missing, that there's immediate rapid response.
The alert system will coordinate with state law enforcement agencies, tribal communities, and state resources when a missing Indigenous person goes missing. The governor has 20 days after the session ends to sign this bill into law and would take effect July 1st. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
The number of Alaska Native language speakers has been declining over the years, including speakers of Aleutic. But a new language class that's live streamed from Port Lions aims to combat that trend locally. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports.
Jamai Kuiana Teluji, hello and welcome. Thank you all for coming to another episode of King's Corner.
Every Thursday, students from the school in the native village of Port Lions discuss Aleutic culture and language. That's in preparation for class lessons and conversations in Aleutic that are live streamed online twice a month. It's the Port Lions students' first time speaking their native language within school through the Aleutic Culture class. That includes practicing everything from weather reports to animals and place names in Aleutic. Jess Egemeyer II, who works for the native village of Port Lions, teaches the class.
You know, I really saw a need for content that was focused on the local community and that would include current events happening in the village and at the school, a local safety bulletin, you know, the weather forecast as you've seen.
Egemeyer says the live stream, which is called King's Corner after the school's mascot, is a product of elders and the previous generation laying the groundwork for language revitalization in Port Lions and around Kodiak Island. That multi-year-long effort by multiple organizations and individuals has led to Aleutic textbooks, digital audio recordings of native speakers, and language courses for college students or even adults.
If we don't teach our children now, this is how languages die, and it's unfortunately not uncommon.
Alaska Native languages in general are at risk of being lost or going extinct as elders who speak the language are passing on. For Koniag or Kodiak Aleutic, which is the dialect mainly spoken in the Kodiak archipelago, less than 20 fluent first language speakers are still alive today. Egemeyer says the class will go through the rest of this semester and he hopes to continue it this summer and next school year too.
We say in Aleutic, Tunk Chukum Gin Chali, I will see you again.
Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
The U.S. Postal Service is hosting a first day of issue ceremony for its Forever Stamps, celebrating powwows. Four stamps showcase paintings of Native dancers by Cochiti Pueblo artist Mateo Romero, featuring women's traditional dance, crow hop dance, men's hoop dance, and women's fancy shawl dance. The ceremony will be held at the Gathering of Nations powwow in April in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, has stopped $500 million in deliveries to food banks nationwide. This comes at a time when Americans are already struggling with high grocery prices and banks are funding large deficits. The consequences were immediate. The Central California Food Bank, which distributes food to 60 pantries, recently learned that 13 truckloads of groceries worth $850,000 were canceled. Natalie Caples, the food bank's co-CEO, said, quote, "My food bank in Fresno can't magically come up with $850,000 and 500,000 pounds of food to backfill that cancellation. It means neighbors are getting less food when they show up at these distribution sites, and they're getting a lesser variety of foods," end quote. The USDA says they are reviewing the funding for these deliveries. Vince Hall from Feeding America noted the problem and the shortages are particularly acute in rural areas, where food banks rely even more on government-supplied groceries. The $500 million in funding came from the USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation, which periodically provides additional resources to purchase food from American farmers and ranchers to send emergency food providers. The USDA also recently announced it is ending two COVID-19-era programs that provided money for food banks and schools to purchase food from local and regional farmers and ranchers, stopping some $1 billion in funding. The USDA itself said that the Biden administration created, quote, unsustainable programming and expectations using the Commodity Credit Corporation, end quote. The agency noted that it continues to buy food for the Emergency Food Assistance Program, spending more than $166 million so far this fiscal year. In addition, it has purchased more than $300 million in various poultry, fish, fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts through another assistance program. Food banks are turning to other supporters, including food retailers and wholesalers, corporations, foundations, and individual donors to try to close at least part of the gap. That will be incredibly hard to do in a short period of time.
New research will help guide the state of Washington's plans to prepare for and adapt to climate change. It aligns with the state's climate resilience strategy, laying out a framework for measuring Washington's flexibility. Isabel Charlet has the details.
In the face of the severe effects of climate change across the country, new research offers a framework for how to measure Washington's climate resilience. The research supports Washington's climate resilience strategy, which was published last year. Carly Stowe with the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group is a lead author on the paper. She says building resilience is critical in order to minimize impacts from droughts, fires, and other extreme weather events.
As the government is investing in resilience, we want to make sure that we're spending that money wisely and that the programs and activities we're investing in are resulting in increased resilience.
Stowe says the research compares Washington's and South Carolina's approaches to climate preparedness to serve as a guide for other states. She adds the research is one way to demonstrate Washington's leadership in this area, as taking these kinds of measurements is a new practice at the state level. Stowe says measuring climate resilience means incorporating data from dozens of sources across communities, infrastructure, land, and governance. It includes air quality levels, damage to infrastructure, and evacuations in extreme events like floods or wildfires. She says it was helpful to partner with South Carolina on this research, even though each state ended up with a different measurement framework.
There's a lot more that we can learn together, and so continuing partnerships like this, I think, is really important for further building resilience across our country.
Stowe says the Washington State Department of Ecology will be implementing these plans, and the public will start seeing initial results of the measurements in September. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Political forces are swirling as a Midwestern company trying to build a multi-state pipeline for carbon emissions storage plots its next move after recent setbacks. North Dakota opponents are worried about safety and property owner rights. As Mike Moen reports, they hope to ride the wave that halted the project's momentum in South Dakota.
There's a court hearing today in a case that pits two North Dakota counties against a large carbon capture project. The legal challenge stands in the shadows of heavier opposition across the border, and opponents here hope for similar momentum. Burley and Emmons counties are appealing permit approval by North Dakota regulators for a multi-state pipeline. A company wants to capture emissions from ethanol plants for underground storage. Safety concerns, local restrictions, and property owners' rights are part of the backlash. Burley County Commissioner Steve Botkin says there's a disconnect between what state leaders who back the project promote versus what they do.
We seem to have a track record building of our legislature liking to speak about local control, except for when it's not convenient for what they want to get through.
This session, North Dakota lawmakers voted down oversight bills for the emerging carbon capture industry. But in South Dakota, concerned property owners have had success, and a new law there has stalled that section of the project. Supporters say the pipeline could help the region's economy by keeping ethanol producers thriving. Today's hearing is for the company's request to dismiss the case. The firm behind the project, Summit Carbon Solutions, has come under scrutiny over its encounters with property owners as it seeks land agreements. Dustin Garvalo of the North Dakota Watchdog Network says organizers don't like how this big project is being forced through. And whether or not the permits stand, he says lawmakers here shouldn't look past the groundswell of opposition.
This time it may not have impacted North Dakota policy or the project here in North Dakota, but ultimately I do believe that down the road, there will be a project that turns the tide in North Dakota on these issues as well.
A key difference in the policy approach of the two states may be North Dakota's stronger connections to the oil and gas industry. The Summit Pipeline also is touted as a way to convert the emissions into fuel sources. That's a main point of contention for environmentalists. Summit has rejected concerns about many aspects of the project and says despite recent obstacles, it will move forward. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
Federal officials aren't sure if two Oregon bridges could survive being hit by a ship. The National Transportation Safety Board released a new list of 68 bridges around the country that need to be analyzed for their stability if they were struck by large watercraft. That includes the St. John's Bridge in Portland and the Astoria-Megler Bridge. It's important, especially in the aftermath of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore last year. It gave way after a cargo ship rammed into its supports. Oregon transportation officials say their bridges are low risk. The Astoria Bridge has fenders to protect it, and the St. John's Bridge has supports in the water. Oregon's bridges also don't see the same large, fast ships that some East Coast ports have. In related local bridge news, the reconstruction of Portland's Burnside Bridge has been delayed. That means the construction wouldn't start until 2028. Multnomah County officials say the delay is because of uncertainty from the Trump administration. Federal funding is in jeopardy, and tariffs could mean big impacts for buying materials, even ones made in America. The bridge will be rebuilt to survive a major Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Currently, none of Portland's bridges are expected to survive the quake, making the new Burnside Bridge a lifeline route. The county considers the bridge its highest priority transportation project. With the delay, though, the design phase will be extended. Once work on the bridge starts, actual construction is expected to take several years.